always amazed when I hear somebody play. I was recently watching something where a composer, because of World War One, and then later World War II, so many people that were in the military lost arms and legs and stuff, started writing and composing for people who could only play with one hand, so that they would not lose their love for music because they learned how to do it. So you never know exactly what place you might have. I couldn't do it with either one, so.
Mr. Ravel was one of those.
Pardon?
Mr. Ravel was one of those.
So, you know, this past, thinking about just the message talking about today, we've been going through a series on extraordinary, obviously, extra, two Greek words put together, extra and ordinary, simply meaning out of the ordinary and beyond the norm. And so when we think about this past year, starting in the new year, obviously we've had a lot of loved ones just in our small church, and a lot of sickness. And questions that you can ask yourself, I've been reflecting on this in the last few weeks. Why has God allowed me to make it to 2022? You ever wonder that? Why am I here and others are gone? Another question, how are you going to walk in His power this year? Am I going to do it or am I going to do it on my own? And one that came to mind a few weeks ago, and the Lord wanted me to speak on the extraordinary. I kept thinking, why in the world everybody knows a story? Why do you talk about a story that everybody already knows? In fact, you all could probably write it and talk about it better than I can. But it made me think a lot about the extraordinary, and the title would be that of times such as this. How many of you feel like you're in the middle of it? Why am I here, and what does God want? So you think about it. Just look at that. Just we'll be in the book of Esther. Let me give you some background. Not only the definition, but I think one thing to keep in mind is Psalms 139, David is writing, and he says that you and I are mentally and physically, God has put us together the way He wants, in your mother's womb, your frame, your abilities. That's why so often when we want or wish we were different, we're actually getting onto who? We're getting onto God. Why'd you put me together this way? It also says He has a plan for you. Before there was ever one day, God already had a plan for you. So how long you are on the earth and what your plans are designed for, He already has. In the end of verse 18 of Psalms 139, He says He also has a partner. He's with you. And that's why it's important to recognize the prayer at the end. You remember in the prayer at the end of Psalms 139, verse 23 and 24, what does David say? Search me, O God, and what? Try me and see if there's any anxious way. How many of us are willing to say, Lord, hey, you can go into every closet, every room of my life, and anything that's there that you need to take out, you can take out. So I think it's important for us to think about that. So the background, we're in the book of Esther, and the background is what you have is the whenever you look at the different ones, you see different names. And so if you'll notice in chapter 1, you see the Hebrew name of the king, Azarias. His Greek name, how many of you know the Greek name? The Greek name is the one you're going to hear see mostly in history. Xerxes the First. That's the Greek name. Then he had a Persian name. And you see it also, we call her Esther. That's not her real name, that's her Persian name. It's amazing when you look at the book, she's called Esther, her Persian name all the way through, but the king's given the Hebrew name. But when you look at it, Xerxes, and you see this, and we're trying to cover the whole book, he reigned for 21 years. From 485 down to 486 down to 465. He also, this book here only covers 10 years of his reign from 483 to 473. And so you look at it. He also, you see in verse 1, how large a province he had. He had 127 provinces. He goes from India to Ethiopia. That's a large territory. A huge territory. What also happens, you don't find it, but between chapter 1 and chapter 2, you find more in history, which we'll talk about what took place and what happens in history. And notice you'll see this as capitals in Susa, and then in verse 3, you notice it's the third year. Remember I told you it was from 486, but the book starts in 483, and then it stops. Then 473, he still reigned 8 more years after the book, because it's primarily talking about Esther. It talks about, if you don't have the book of Esther, you do not know about the Feast of Purim. So part of it's why it's included here, so we know about the history. So here you have it. It's rain, and notice then it's very vast. He gives a great party. You notice in verse 4, you think about it. He gives a party that lasts, and he pays for it all, and lasts 180 days. They're on a 360-day year calendar, a lunar calendar, so he gives a party for half a year, and he finances it. You think about all the amount of money and waste that you have. After he finishes it, notice then he decides to give another party in verse 5 that lasts 7 more days. And while he's giving this party, obviously there's a lot of drinking. He gets drunk, and you notice in verse 9, the queen also gives a party for a week. And while he is drunk, what he does then, this is the background, he basically asks the queen, who's very beautiful, to come out in a nightgown and parade in front of everybody. And she rightly refuses. And it makes the king mad, and if you look at his leadership, which is insane, but his leaders say, well, you find this later in chapter 1, the leaders say, well, she's wrong, and every woman in all the land is going to not obey their husband. So you need to then banish her and make it written in law that every woman in the entire place is to abide by every rule her husband says. And he writes it, which is insane. But what happens between chapter 1 and chapter 2 is in history. And what happens is he goes off to war, and he goes off, he wants to expand his empire, and he goes off to fight Greece. Because Greece obviously has to go across the channel, and Greece is separate, and he wants to expand his kingdom into Europe, and he is soundly defeated in 479. He comes back defeated, and he now starts, by the way, Herodias, who also writes about this in history. But he comes back, and now he's thinking about he needs a queen, and he comes back. So that's why there's a time frame that takes place. So that gets us then into chapter 2. So he comes back, and it's amazing what he does to get a queen. And the reason I'm doing this, there's 4 main characters in the book. And I want us to think about each one, how we'd respond. Obviously, you have Esther, you have the king Ahasuerus, and you have Mordecai, and then you have Haman. And you have those 4 main ones that you have. So now he comes back, and what he does, the recommendation is, okay, you have 127 provinces, and we're going to send men out, and every beautiful virgin you find in the whole kingdom are all going to be brought, and you get to pick them. How would you feel if that was your daughter? Somebody just comes along and grabs her, granddaughter, whatever, and says, she's beautiful, we're taking her to the king. It's important to recognize that, because you think about that then if you're Mordecai. So here they're gathered, and you find this in verse 1 down to verse 7 of chapter 2. And you notice in verse 7, it says, now, talking about Mordecai was bringing up Hadassah, which you notice is Esther in verse 7, his uncle's daughter, for she had neither father or mother. Now, the young lady is beautiful of form and face. When her father and mother passed away, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. So he's raising her as his daughter, and now all of a sudden the king takes her. And what happens then, notice then, the king, you notice in verse 8, all the young virgins are placed, come to Susa, the capital, and are placed in custody of Haggai, the Esther, who is in charge of all the virgin women, a eunuch. Notice then, verse 9, it's amazing how this takes place. The young lady, talking about Esther, pleased him and found favor with him, so he quickly provided with her cosmetics, food, gave her 7 choice maidens from the king's palace, and transferred her and her maids to the best place in the harem. It's interesting, nowhere in the book of Esther do you find God mentioned, but you find God's sovereignty and things going on all the time. So God's looking out for, and you'll notice in verse 11, Mordecai walks back and forth every day checking on her. But how would you be feeling if you're Mordecai? Okay, so here you have it. This is kind of the background. And notice then how long they have. So in verse 12, this would have started in Notice 12, they have 12 months to get ready. All the cosmetics that they have to get themselves looking and smelling the very best they can. You put all the oils and stuff on every day, it's going to then basically permeate your skin, and wherever you would go, you'd smell that way and look that way. And notice then, in verse 13, each time when a different lady would come in and be with the king, and she could bring anything with him or with her, in verse 13 and 14, after that evening with the king, they now go into the custody of another eunuch and become a concubine. So basically, he has this great harem. He's adding to his harem, and they're all coming in. He has one, all right. Basically, he must have had a book and their names and writes it down. You go to the next one. He gets another one. Now, how are you going to be feeling right now if you're Esther or if you're Mordecai? Is that what you dreamt for your daughter, or is that what you dreamt for your life? I mean, this is not the kind of life, but this is what they had. And so notice then, it's interesting in verse 15, something else that Esther does that's wise is notice it tells you what her mother's name is and who she is. But notice at the end, she asks, what does the king like? She asked, obviously, the guy who's in charge knows the color the king likes, knows all those different things. Most of the time, you think about it, we would wear what we like. If you're wanting to win the king and get the position, what does he like? So she asks, and notice it's interesting in the verse 15 at the end, Esther found favor in the eyes of all who saw her. So obviously, everybody agrees what? That's the best choice. And notice then, in verse 16, she becomes king in the seventh year of his reign. So notice it starts in the third year, and this is the seventh year. So it takes this long for him to go off to a military battle, to lose, to come home, for all these women to come and to be coming before him, and he selects. And here she is. So when you think about it, you have all this. And it says, notice in 17, he loved her more than all the others. But he still has others. Again, how would you feel? Now, it's interesting, after she becomes queen, he has a banquet for her. But how many of you have ever read verse 19? And when the virgins were gathered together a second time, you ever notice that? He has all of them come. He then selects Esther. But hey, I want to have some more in my harem. So I'm going to gather all of them a second time and go through this again. And how would you be feeling if you're Mordecai and what he's doing for your daughter? And how would you be feeling if you're the queen? And he has all these other women. So I guess I think it's important for us to look at. And by the way, how old do you think she was? Late teens, maybe early 20s, late teens, more than likely. Think about it. How you'd feel. So it's important for us to look at it. So here you have the kind of the background you see with Esther. Obviously, a question you can ask yourself, how many of us would react if you're in Esther's position? How many of us would be asking, okay, I recognize God's given me favor by putting me with the right people. How many of us would ask for what is best? How many of us would see God's hand in it? I think a lot of us wouldn't see God's hand in any of it. Did Joseph see God's hand when he was sent off down to Egypt? Genesis 15 and verse 20, he did. So I think it's important. Notice the second thing, remember that's part of Esther, we'll get more to her in a minute. The second person we want to look at, remember, was Mordecai. And if you remember in Mordecai, it's interesting, in chapter 3 and verse 2, he would not bow down. Haman is the third character that we have, or the fourth one. He's second in command, and the king is given orders in verse 2 of chapter 3 for everybody to bow down. And Mordecai, because of Deuteronomy chapter 6 and so on, he wouldn't do it. And so Haman is very upset when he goes around and everybody as a whole is bowing down, but Mordecai won't. And Mordecai won't because he was told not to bow down because he's not divine, you only bow before God. So here you have, you think about it, you think about Mordecai. He was devoted to God. He was devoted to Esther too, wasn't he? Because he checked on her every single day. He raised her correctly. But notice something else as you go back then to chapter 2. Notice in verse 21, chapter 2 of Esther. In those days, while Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, so he does have a leadership position, two of the king's officials from who guarded the door became angry and sought to lay hands on the king. If you're Mordecai, would you keep your mouth shut? Because how many of you would like what the king has done to your daughter? You hear about a plot to kill the king, and obviously she's the queen, but it wasn't exactly a marriage that you'd like your daughter to be involved in, or your niece. What do you do? Notice then he's devoted to the king also because he makes makes it known to the queen, and she then on his behalf goes before the king. And in verse 23, they investigate it and find out the plot to be true, and they kill it. The two people who were plotting to kill the king. So you think about it, he's devoted to God, he's devoted to Esther, he's devoted to the king. It's also, if you jump forward, now this would have been at the end of the book, just jump over to the last chapter since we're just talking about Mordecai for a moment. This would have been written at the end, which would have been 10 years from the beginning of the book. And notice in verse 2 and 3 of chapter 10 of Esther. And all the accomplishments of his authority, talking about the king, and all the strength and full account of the greatness of Mordecai to which the king advanced him, he then was put second in charge. Are they not written in the book of Chronicles of the kings of Media and Persia? For Mordecai the Jew was second only to King Ahasuerus and great among the Jews, in favor of the multitude of the kinsmen, one, notice what it says about it, one who sought the good of his people, one who spoke for the welfare of the whole nation. Isn't that what you want in a politician? Now you think about it. So here you have Mordecai. He's devoted to God. He's devoted to Esther. He's devoted to the king. And he's devoted to his people. Everything he does is in relationship to helping them. And it's amazing when you look at it, who are we devoted to? If you were in it, Mordecai's position, you found out about that plot, what would you do? And by the way, 465 is a new person in his position. The king is no longer king. A new king comes along. Mordecai is removed from it. And if you look at history, a new person is in that position. 8 years. So for 8 years, he's in that position. And look at what all he does for his people in the 8 years. And this was being written even in history of the Medes and the Persians. Did a great job. You think about it. What about you and I? Remember a time like this. How important is Mordecai to this story? And for his people, it's amazing when you look at it. I think it's important too. How many of us would be open to do all that? Serve God, serve people, your daughter, adopted daughter. Let's think about Haman, because he is very important in the story. Haman, if you notice his descendant in chapter 3 and verse 1, he was from Esau, and obviously the nations of Esau were at odds with Israel, and so he was obviously trying to get even and wanting to kill, and you'll notice he's second in command, and he basically was told people to bow down to him, so his distinction, the decree was for everybody to bow down. So when Mordecai then doesn't bow down to Haman, he's going against who? He's going against the king. Previous chapter, he even gives a plot that reveals a plot against the king. But it's more important, according to Acts 5:29, to obey who? Obey God rather than man. So you obey God and you obey man, but when it comes down to where man's telling you to go something against God, you can break it. But notice you can suffer the consequences. Well, what happens is I always call it the Haman mentality. Haman gets so mad. Why is he so mad? You're second in command. Everybody's bowing down to you. You're worth a fortune. And you're upset about what? one man not bowing down to you. How many of us, you know, everything's going right, but one thing's going wrong, and what do we think about it? The one thing that's going wrong. Instead of looking at all the things that are going right. And I thought, so I often, in my mind, I just call it the Haman mentality. You're so upset about the one thing, and it's going to end up costing his life because of it. And here he has it. So here you have the distinction, the decree. And then that's interesting. They go to him every day. Why aren't you bowing down? Why aren't you bowing down? So notice in verse 4, he finally tells them that he is a Jew. Okay? Now that Mordecai knows he's a Jew and he's an Agag, notice then he realizes, okay, if he won't bow down to me, and any other Jew that's going to follow the law correctly won't bow down to me, I've got to do what?
Get rid of
it. I've got to get rid of all of it. Now think about then, you come down to him, you think also then about the king. He now then has had a deal where he meets with the king. You find that in verse 7. And when he meets with the king, he basically tells the king, he doesn't tell him who they are or anything else, but oh, you have a people who don't abide by your rules. They won't do, follow your laws. And, of course, you're the king. Man, you mean I'm giving laws and they won't abide by it? We need to get rid of these people. He also offers this great sum of money. That's why when Esther in the next chapter said we've been sold, the reason Haman was willing to give such a huge amount of money, of course, that's going to appeal to the king, is because the king tells him, when you kill all these people, all their possessions you can have. So I can then go say, all right, I'm going to then give you $2 million, but I'm going to go wipe out all these people and I get all these possessions. What's going to happen? More than likely, I'm going to be recouping all my losses and everything else and I get rid of these. He's so concerned about how many people bowing down to him. It's all he cares about. He cares about all this. But how many of us want our way only? No matter what, we'll go to any length to get our way. And that's the way that Haman is. And so the decree goes out, and he signs it, and it's sent to every province in a given time. So it's going to happen. It's going to be basically within the year, about 8 months later. So it goes out to all 127 provinces, and it says all the Jews are mourning, because obviously what? The authority of the king is every single Jewish person can be killed in all 127 provinces, from Ethiopia to India. All of it, everyone. So you think about it, and Haman's doing all this for what? Because people won't bow down to him. And he'll wipe out all these people, and the king doesn't really care a whole lot about people either. It's just, you know, they come and they go, and I'm over all of them, and I don't care, I'm getting prestige, I'm getting money. And so I think we can think about it, how many of us have that Haman mentality? You know, we all need to think about what doesn't go right. I think it's interesting, how many lengths will we go to get our own way? How many times do we only tell half-truths? You ever had people tell you half-truth, and you immediately do, and all of a sudden you realize you made a big mistake? And obviously the king is listens to unwise counsel, which, by the way, do you listen to unwise counsel when he got rid of his first queen because she wouldn't go out and do what she shouldn't have done to begin with? So it's a trait that he has. Let's think a little bit more about Esther then. So here you have the decree that goes out. And notice that Mordecai in chapter 4, he hears about it. And he dressed in sackcloth, as do the Jews throughout. And he comes to the king's gate. He can't go into the king's presence or go in because there's no mourning allowed around the king. And Esther sees it. And she wants to know why. She tries to bring, get him to change his dress or whatever. And Mordecai won't do it. And notice then in verse 5, Esther has a new eunuch that's over. Remember, you have the eunuchs that's over the virgins. You have the eunuch that's over the concubines. And then she has her own to take care of her, and as well as all her servants. And notice then, down when this person comes in verse 6, notice in verse 7 of chapter 4, Mordecai told him, talk about the eunuch, all that had happened to him, the exact amount of money that Haman had promised to pay the king's treasuries, for the destruction of the Jews. He even gave him a copy of the text of the edict, which had been issued in Susa for their destruction, that he might show Esther and inform her, and to order her to go to the king to implore his favor and to plead with him for her people. Now, how would you like to be the queen? Think about it. You know, the Medes and Persians, when they make a law, you can't change it. You saw that in the book of Daniel, chapter 6 later, but Daniel chapter 6, when he said, throw him Daniel in the lion's den, he couldn't change it. You can't change, once Persia was signed, you cannot change the law. It's the law of the Medes and Persians. I heard that a lot when I was a kid, when my dad would say something. Dad, no, that's the law of the Medes and Persians. It won't change. I tell you to clean the room, or I tell you to mow the yard, it's the law of the Medes and Persians. You better get it. So I've known about this law a long time. So you notice then, it's interesting what Esther does. Now, if you think about it, if you're Esther, starting in verse 10, Esther spoke and ordered then, obviously, through the servant. In verse 11, all the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that for any man or woman who comes to the king to an inner court who is not summoned, he has but one law, that he be put to death, unless he, the king, holds out his golden scepter so that he may live. And I have not been summoned to go to the king these 30 days. So obviously, how important is the queen to the king? I mean, obviously not that important. It's a symbol, basically, and whenever he wants her, he does. Otherwise, he can go wherever and do what he wants with whomever he wants. And he hasn't asked me for 30 days. I go in his presence, and he doesn't want me. What happens? He's already done it to Vashti. He can do it to me, and he has plenty of others to choose from. Why do it? Why risk that for that? You think about it. So then obviously the guy comes back in verse 11. The eunuch comes back and tells Mordecai. And here's the key for the whole book. When you look at it, notice the response that Mordecai has to Esther. Mordecai told them to reply to Esther, do not imagine that you and the king's palace can escape any more than any or of all the Jews. For if you remain silent, at this time, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another place, and you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not been attained royalty for such a time as this. Does Mordecai recognize God's in charge of everything? Okay. He's saying what? I believe you're in this position to save the Jewish people by going to the king. Oh, but he hasn't asked for me. He's saying, if you don't go, God's going to save his people. He's already promised with Abraham that he will. And if you don't do it, he'll bring somebody else up. How many times does God want us to do something and we don't do it, and God gets it done, and he uses somebody else? So that's why I've asked before, why are we allowing, is God allowing us to still be here today? He has something for us, and what are we doing? Now, it's interesting what she does. I think it's very important to look at it, to recognize your place. But notice, in chapter 4 through chapter 6, she relies on God. It's important. Her young age, notice what she says in verse 16. Go assemble all the Jews who are found in Susa. Fast from me. Do not eat or drink 3 days and nights. And I and my maidens, so obviously she's been a witness to them too, will also fast in the same way. And thus I'll go into the king, which is not according to the law, and if I perish, I perish. Notice then, okay, I'm going to do it, but I'm relying on the Lord. I want you to start fasting. You and every Jew in the entire capital. Everybody to fast. Why would that be important? Couldn't you just do one? How many like the prayers of more than just one? The prayer of a righteous man availeth much, showing the dependency of every single one, that it's important. Every person in Susa of Jewish descent, how important is this decision to them? Their entire life. Everyone's going to be killed. It's important. How do you think you would have fasted? Do you think you'd be praying? Now, when you go on then, notice then she then, starting in chapter 5, you'll notice then she asks for a request, a banquet with, she goes in and the king then puts out the scepter in 2, and in verse 3, he says, "What's troubling you, Queen Esther? What's your request? I'll give you up to half the kingdom." Well, that's pretty nice. 127 provinces, I mean, that's worth quite a bit. And notice then she says, "I'm going to give a banquet and I want you and Haman to come tomorrow." Now it's interesting, I hear, I read a lot, when they come to the banquet the next day, she postpones it, and I hear people write all the time, "She chickened out." I don't believe she chickened out whatsoever. Because what happens the next night and the next day is critical to the story. I believe under the inspiration of God, she felt led, because they're all praying, that she should not do it yet. Because what happens in the next 24 hours totally changes the entire outcome of this story. So they're all praying, she goes, and then she feels led by God not to say something. So she says, "Come back tomorrow." Let's look at what happens then in that 24-hour period. You'll notice from 9 down, just as chapter 5, 9 down to 14, Haman goes out again, and he's so happy and he's so pleased that he's going to have an audience with the king and the queen, and he's just, "Oh man, look at me, I'm so great." Oh boy. And then Mordecai won't bow down to it. And he gets so mad, and he tells his wife, and she says, "All right, verse, you know, it's 14. Build gallows tonight." So they worked all night building these gallows, and notice how tall are they?
50 cubits.
50 cubits, which is, a cubit is how much?
A foot and a half.
Why do you need gallows 75 feet tall? So everybody can see it. So he's building the gallows to hang him on. He wants it to be known. Notice the second thing that happens. Chapter 6 and verse 1, the king can't sleep. Possibly he can't sleep because he wants to know what the request is the queen's going to ask him. While he's doing this, he reads and he finds out that Mordecai saved his life. And he says, "What's been done to Mordecai, the Jew?" And he says, "Nothing." And I'm thinking, man, we ought to do something for this guy that saved my life. So the next morning, here you have Haman coming in early. And he thinks this is all going to be great. And look at this. And now the king says, "Hey, what should we do for somebody who's great in my kingdom and done these things for me?" Of course, Haman thinks it's what? It's me. Oh, I'm so good. He's talking about me. And then he has to lead Mordecai around, and he's paying homage to him. Now then, when he comes into the king and the queen at the banquet, now when Esther says, "Haman is against the Jews and against all of us," he can say what? It is true, because Haman is trying to destroy him. And look at the gallows he's built. Haman is wanting to destroy all this because of the decree. And Mordecai the Jew is not trying to destroy you. He saves you. And notice then, that's why the king gets so upset and why he orders him immediately hung on his own gallows. I think it's important, again, what you see in this. It's just amazing when you see this, what takes place. God is throughout this whole book. His name may not be mentioned, but God is over all of it. But I think it's important when you look at it, you think about it, am I open to correction? Was Esther going to go in? But Mordecai had it pointed out to her, didn't he? But then she was willing. Do I see God's hand at work in everything? It's an interesting deal. I was supposed to give this to you earlier, and I forgot. This was sent to me, Marilyn, who's obviously in the hospital, and Bob. They sent this to me. Tell me what you think of this. This is the prayer they were given for today. May God make this year a happy one, not by shielding us from sorrow and pain, but by strengthening us to bear it as it comes. Not by making our path easy, but by giving us strength to travel any path. Not by taking hardships from us, but taking fear from our hearts. not by granting unspoken, unbroken sunshine, but by keeping our gaze fixed on you. Nor not by making life always pleasant, but by showing us where we are needed most, and by placing us there to help. It's interesting, Marilyn texting, because obviously her room has been the relief. Nurses have been coming in there, some of them even crying, coming in there with what all they're dealing with at the hospital. She's been a witness with all the stuff going on with their knee. You never know where God's placed us and what are we doing where we're at. So let's think about it. How many of us have the Haman problem? Oh, it's all about me? What about Mordecai? Amazing. Mordecai spoke up when he needed to. He thought of his people. He thought of his family. He thought of God. Amazing. And how many of us are like the king? We just care about ourselves. We don't care anything about anybody else. So think about it. I think we're all here today, 2022, for a reason. A time such as this, what is God wanting from us in this year? And how can we serve?